Well, good day and welcome to another episode here of the Disaster Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and we are back here after the holiday weekend for Thanksgiving. And I hope everybody were safe and had a good time with their families and are full of turkey and stuffing and all the other good stuff. We are going to get into some more of our elevated CPR, heads up CPR series here tonight. And I'm looking forward to that because we're really going to be digging into the science and the physiology here in this episode, which I think will help people really see the benefits of what we're getting to. Without too much more ado, though, we do need to bring in my co-host Sam and let her lead off this discussion. So, hey, Sam.
Hey there. Hey, I want to thank Dan and Becky for the snow, finally. We got a real nice dump yesterday, about 6 inches here in Colorado, and it's still out there. It's been cold enough. It hasn't gone away. So thank you, Dan. What else is going on out there?
Yeah, you're welcome, Sam. It seems like most of the country, actually, in the U.S. here, dealing with some early season winter weather. Winter has not waited around this year. You said you had your first major snow of the season there in Colorado. It was later than usual, though. Most of the time that happens in earlier in November, but it took a while, but still got our first snow in Colorado. We've got it's been some record cold temperatures, Midwest, Great Lakes, single digits, big Arctic outbreak really for early in the season. So some record low temperatures. Big a couple of different snowstorms. Chicago's already picked up close to a foot or more of snow on the season so far. New York has missed out. They continue to not be able to get snow in New York, it seems like. And as we record this on Thursday night, we're expecting some snow on Friday in Washington, D.C. Not a lot of snow, but anytime you get snow in Washington, D.C. or down in Virginia, you get some challenges with roads, it seems like. So just even an inch or two can cause some problems, which is what should fall down there. So certainly a chilly start of the month of December in a lot of the country.
Yes, it is. It just seems like it took a while for, you know, out here we can get it as early as October. So, but when we got it good. So, Kurt, we have Kurt, we have Becky with us, and of course, Dr. Joe. And we're going to jump into the main part of what we've been getting around to, and that's head up CPR. What is it? What does it do? Why is it good? So this is seen as a novel research in resuscitation. A lot of people think it's an advancement. And one of the issues with CPR all along was limited neurologic survival. So let's see what this does. So, Kirk, can you jump in and kind of let us know how it started? And I think one of the things I remember is that ski hill resuscitation. Can you reiterate that?
I sure can. Thanks, Sam. And thanks to you guys for having me back for more of this discussion. And I'll just say up front that I get pretty excited talking about this. So I'll try to keep it calm for the audience. So the ski hill story was really, it was a case that happened during a trial, a study looking at active compression, decompression, CPR in conjunction with an ITD. And this particular individual, a male, as far as I understand it, had a cardiac arrest on the ski hill, and the ski patrols were using these devices as part of the resuscitation. And that individual survived their cardiac arrest, which is a miracle enough. And what nobody realized or even considered as a variable was the fact that he was on an incline and his head was elevated relative to the rest of his body, or his head and thorax were actually elevated as relative to his body. And to consider that that would have been an impactful or meaningfully impactful variable to the whole thing, it just was never really picked up on. And so looking back from what we know now, it's raises more questions about, gosh, how much did that play into the success of that resuscitation?
Yes, and being a former ski patroller, we always go feet down. So anybody that goes on a ski hill is already ahead. You mentioned, and I'm curious about this, some initial goals and surprise discoveries once you started realizing some of these things, and maybe that head up was the key.
Yeah, so the origination of this is just a cool story in and of itself. And in short form, Dr. Lurie was visiting Seoul, South Korea, and was engaged in conversation with a number of people over there. And one of them was a physician who's really is in charge of most of the EMS system there. And in their discussion, what he learned was that the majority of the 11 million people that live in that city, they live in high rises, typically 40 stories high. But those high rises have these very small elevators, what I call single occupancy elevators. You'll see similar things like in the Miami area of Florida. And the challenge is you cannot lay a patient supine, that the elevator just simply isn't large enough. And so what they had started to develop was a modified EMS stretcher that would put them in a sort of an odd position. If you imagine sitting in a chair, you know, at, you know, your knees are 90 degrees and your hips are 90 degrees. And then if I lay that chair on its back, so your thighs would be pointing straight up in the air. So they developed this stretcher to do this, to shorten the patient, keep the torso flat so they could continue CPR while they're traversing in the elevator. And the Korean physician was, you know, rather proud of what they had developed in order to improve their ability to move these patients, and asked Dr. Lurie his opinion. He said, I don't think that's going to be really great for the patient. The Korean doctor's like, well, no, this is like Trendelenburg, and, you know, a very logical approach that we have this hypotensive state, profound hypotensive state. We want to move the blood towards the vital organs. And Dr. Lurie's thought on that was, yes, but the blood isn't going to stop at the vital organs. All that pressure is going to push up into the head. And long story short, they both realized nobody ever asked this question: what's the best position for doing CPR? So it became a very legitimate research question that they brought back to the Minneapolis area and began to study under animal studies. And right from the very first study, they had some very profound findings, namely that when we do CPR in a supine position, it elevates the pressure in the head more than anybody, I think, ever realized or knew that it did. When you put the specimen in a head down position, that pressure gets to a lethal level inside the head. And in turn, as they were changing position through the study, and now the head was in an elevated position, finally the pressure in the head started to drop, and that very first pig began to gasp, showing a return of brain function, you know, more specifically a brain stem, you know, sending a signal through the phrenic nerve to cause the pig to gasp. So that was the launch of this whole thing, going, there's something going on here that we didn't previously understand.
Yes, indeed. Joe, I want you to tag on to that. And also, I'm going to let you loose on some physiology here, because I know that's your thing. And just tag along to what Kurt was saying about what they found out. But it's all about the blood, from what I understand. So I'm going to let you run with that.
Well, that's pretty accurate. Actually, before I jump too far off into that, because I get very excited about that, just another comment on what Kurt just said, and that is there is a definite correlation between patients who are attempting to breathe, doing the little gasping motions or guppy breathing, as some people call it. And it's important for rescuers to realize that if you see that in your patient, your chances of a successful resuscitation are significantly better, because it tells you that the brainstem is being perfused to some extent, and the chances of a of ROSC are actually better in those patients. So that's a very positive indicator if you see that.
Yes, indeed.
All right. So let's talk physiology here for a couple of minutes. And what I'd like to do is sort of talk about CPR in general, and then talk about the ways that some of the tools, devices, and techniques that we have been discussing over the last couple of weeks help to maximize our ability to manipulate the physiology to our advantage. So here we go. Think about CPR in cardiac arrest in a much more simplistic way than I think we do in general. In essence, what we are trying to do is create differences in pressures inside the body, because differences in pressures are what result in flow. So just like it happens with the garden hose at home, if you put high pressure water on one end, it squirts out the other end because fluids move from high pressure to low pressure. So if you think about the two areas of the body that we are primarily concerned about in cardiac arrest, they are the heart and the brain. And so I'm going to just talk about those two areas because those are our key focuses of cardiac resuscitation. So in CPR, when we compress the chest, well, let me back up a second. When we have a cardiac arrest, the pressures inside our thoracic cavity and our brain are at some baseline. I'm going to call that zero, just for simplicity's sake. So when you compress the chest during CPR, you raise the pressure in the thoracic cavity to some elevated number, say 40 millimeters of mercury. Again, I'm just sort of making up numbers here for the sake of education. So the pressure in the chest is now 40. The pressure outside the chest is zero. So blood is going to flow from the chest to other areas that are lower pressure, most importantly, the brain. The increased pressure in the chest is pushing both arterial and venous blood out of the thoracic cavity. And we happen to push out perhaps a little more arterial blood because we happen to have some valvular assistance from the valves of the heart, et cetera, on the arterial side. When we let off on the chest and we allow the chest to recoil to its baseline state, the pressure in the chest goes back to baseline, the zero. The pressure in the brain is still zero. There's no pressure differential there, and so flow is not very good during that time. The reason that that's important is that because there's not much of a pressure head to generate blood flow, there is not great venous return into the thoracic cavity and the heart. And the heart, being a completely passive organ, meaning it doesn't suck blood into it, it requires pressure differentials and blood flow to fill the atria and then the ventricles, in other words, preload, in order to create anything to pump. Whatever flows into the heart is what is pumped out of the heart. And if nothing flows in, nothing flows out. So even the best CPR in situations where the intrathoracic pressure is high are very ineffective because there is no blood coming into the heart to give us anything to pump. The pressure is holding it all outside the thoracic cavity. That's why overventilation incomplete recoil, all of those different things are so incredibly detrimental in CPR and cardiac arrest, and why we try to avoid them. We've known this about overventilation for a long time. So let's try taking this physiology. Well, let me pause a second and make sure nobody has any questions, and we'll go on to sort of phase two.
Jamie, you have any thoughts?
No, I'm following this. It jives with my understanding of how the blood flows in the body and the importance of preload is so important on what we're going to get on cardiac output. So I'm really interested to see how we get that blood to the brain if we aren't getting it there currently.
Well, I think we are getting it there, but with some limitations, and I'll address those as we move forward. So as sort of the next way that we potentially can manipulate this physiology is to realize that we're pretty good on the pushing the fluid out of the chest and potentially into the brain. We're not great at the return side, the pull, if you will. Okay? So what we need is a way to create a larger pressure difference between the thoracic cavity and the brain, particularly on the return side, meaning when the chest is returning to its baseline, right? It's been compressed and now it's recoiling back to normal. So if we use the ITD, the rescue pod, that device works by having a pressure-sensitive valve in it that blocks airflow into the thoracic cavity until a certain level of vacuum or negative pressure is generated inside the chest. So the effect of that is exactly the same as you attempting to suck a really thick milkshake through a straw. If you try to do that, you know how hard you have to suck, right? You generate significant vacuum in your chest when you do that. So that valve in the ITD will not open and allow air to rush in, canceling out the vacuum, until you reach minus 16 centimeters of water of vacuum. That's why it's an ITD 16. So think about what's happening now. We compress the chest. We create a pressure of positive 40. Again, I'm sort of picking numbers here. Inside the chest, the pressure in the brain is zero effectively. We have a pressure difference, so we have flow out of the chest and into the brain and other parts. When we let off on the chest, we remove the pressure and we allow the chest to recoil to normal. If the ITD is in place, now the pressure in the thoracic cavity goes down to minus 16 before the valve opens and allows air to rush in and the vacuum to go away. But the pressure in the chest is now minus 16, while the pressure in the brain is zero. We have a pressure difference, therefore we have flow. And that pressure difference is going the other direction. It's going from the head to the chest. So that does two things. That helps to pull venous blood out of our head to free up space for arterial blood, the stuff we want there. It reduces intracranial pressure, and that improved flow fills the heart more effectively. So the next time we compress the chest, we have more blood to pump. Following me so far?
Aha. I think every medical person out there, regardless of level, should listen to this, because this is the first time I think I've truly understood what actually happens.
Good. Well, it gets better. So So sort of the third phase of this is, if we could get gravity to help us return blood from the head to the thoracic cavity, that would be even better, right? So if we raise the head and chest during high quality CPR with the ITD, we can let gravity assist us additionally to return more blood out of the head and into the thoracic cavity, filling the heart even more and emptying the head even more, and reducing intracranial pressure inside the head. Intracranial pressure in the head is a resistance to flow in the brain. So the higher the intracranial pressure, the less flow in the brain that you have. So heads up CPR is combining the effects of enhanced vacuum inside the chest during recoil with the addition of gravity assistance to flow blood downhill into our heart. Because we are filling the heart more effectively, we have the ability to overcome the need to pump blood uphill because we've raised the head. But it's the enhancement in return of blood out of the brain and into the chest, the improvement in blood into the heart, and the reduction in resistance in the brain and the more space, quote unquote, inside your head for arterial blood as opposed to venous blood that results in the clinical stuff that we've seen with this technique that we'll talk much more about later on. But in essence, neuroprotective CPR, better brain outcomes in patients who are resuscitated with heads up CPR.
And that's the real goal, isn't it?
Absolutely. That is absolutely the real goal. So that, I think if we'll think about CPR in a way that makes the physiology make more sense, meaning we're trying to do things to manipulate pressure changes, it makes all of this stuff make a lot more sense. And it's certainly consistent with all the research that has been done, not only clinical research, but physiologic animal research and studies going back forever related to the pros and cons of manipulation of pressure inside the thoracic cavity and the effect that that has on blood flow, cardiac output, perfusion, etc.
I also have a note on entitled CO2 and how that affects CPR-induced consciousness, which of course means there's increased perfusion, correct?
Yeah, increased entitled CO2 is a reflection of better perfusion. And obviously, better perfusion means the chance that your brain is going to wake up and start doing something, responding in some meaningful way in a much more likely occurrence because of the improved circulation. So it's not the entitled CO2 that's doing that. It's the fact that better perfusion is resulting in increased entitled CO2 levels, effectively normal entitled CO2 levels in several studies that we'll talk about later.
Okay. Kurt, I'm going to let you have this one and then have Joe comment on it too. And I know this is something really important to you, and that's the four rules of heads up CPR and what not to do.
Yeah, Sam, this is a critical piece of the message for anyone listening. In about 2019, Dr. Joanna Moore, who has been one of the principal investigators behind this entire thing that we call head up CPR, or neuroprotective CPR. And she was responding to some other studies, or a study that came out of, I think, another country, as I recall, but they didn't have good results in their lab studies. And it led to her publishing an editorial that was called The Do's and Don'ts. And I now call those the four rules of head-up CPR. And very simply, what they are is you cannot do this effectively or safely if you're not using suction cup CPR in conjunction with an ITD or rescue pod. We need those tools as circulatory adjuncts to increase the cardiac output in order to be able to pump the blood uphill to the head, like Dr. Joe had said. Rule number two is you need to have what we call a priming period. So when the patient is initially positioned in a very, very slightly elevated position, there needs to be a period of high quality CPR using these tools to ensure that we've got good blood flow before we elevate them any further. We call that a priming period. Rule number three is you cannot lift the patient too high. And rule number four is you cannot lift the patient too fast or too quickly. If we elevate them too quickly, then gravity is going to pull blood from the head faster than CPR will allow it to be pumped back in. So you need to create a balance. And what I've shared with a lot of people is there's a number of studies, published studies out there, that suggest that head-up CPR doesn't work. And those are really important studies because you'll see two things from those. One is that every single one of those studies violated one or more of those four rules. And that gives us really important information to know that there is a right and a wrong way to do this. So in a practical sense, the takeaway is unless you have the right equipment, do not start raising the head of the stretcher or the head of a bed or using wedge pillows. All of those things will cause you to violate one or more of the four rules, and that's just not a safe environment. But that's true of everything we do in EMS. I mean, you know, monitors, defibrillators can be dangerous if you don't use them correctly. So this isn't meant to be a scary message, just a cautionary message that there is a right and wrong way.
Well, we certainly want it to work, right, Joe?
Well, absolutely. And I will reiterate what Kirk said. It is not as simple as raising the head without addressing several other extremely important details. And those are the quality of your CPR, the enhancements to CPR that we discussed earlier, because that addition and tweak to the physiology here is vitally important to ensure that we are continuing to get good perfusion. Trying to do it in either too fast, too high, or too quickly, a manner that is faster than the physiology can respond, and thus resulting in worse perfusion and obviously worse outcomes. So the importance of doing it correctly and paying attention to those extremely important details is the difference between high quality medicine and just winging it. And please do not just wing it. You will have worse outcomes. You are not doing the right thing if you are not doing it correctly.
It sounds like you're talking about a bundled care approach and the synergistic effect of that. You got to have all the right parts and pieces and do it correctly, right?
Well, there is no question about that. Again, I think, as Kurt mentioned, if you look at some of these other studies where those important details were not followed as they should have been, and noting that the outcomes were worse, maybe even worse than regular, quote-unquote, CPR, then that tells you the answers to the questions, right? If you're not going to do it the right way, you shouldn't be trying to do pieces or parts of it. It requires all those different important details be addressed and done properly in order to stay within a fairly narrow set of parameters by which this physiology is beneficial.
Sam, I would just add to that, that you've touched on, I think, an interesting aspect of this. We started saying this was a novel approach to resuscitation, a novel approach to CPR, and that really hits in two areas. Changing body position is novel in and of itself, but this bundled care approach where we're getting a synergistic effect, that is specifically the combination of changing body position in conjunction with active compression decompression CPR in conjunction with the rescue pod or ITD, we've not seen that in the literature for resuscitation in general. And it kind of goes back to a previous episode where we talked about a lot of this research and how we're trying to isolate these different therapies in a manner to understand their influence or impact on resuscitation. And there's something of perhaps a culture within medicine that has somehow prevented us from understanding that there's an opportunity here to have a bundled approach, a synergistic approach to improve our results with resuscitation. And it's not new to medicine, this bundled approach. We've seen this in things like treatment for AIDS. And I think we maybe talked about this previously, but where in the 90s, where pharmacology was coming out with different drugs to try to treat the HIV virus that were not effective. But somebody figured out if I use a drug cocktail using several of these drugs in concert with one another, suddenly it was wildly effective. And we said the same thing about treating acute sepsis, where we're doing labs, we're giving fluids to support the blood pressure, we're starting antibiotics aggressively, and in many times giving vasopressors to further support blood pressure to attack that disease process from as many angles as possible to maximize their opportunity for success. And that's really what this is for resuscitation, but it's novel in that regard.
Indeed. Jamie, you have a question.
Yeah, and I think this is the point. I think is something that just kind of lit a light bulb in my head was, you know, you can't just raise the torso and the head at an angle and continue doing CPR. That there's a very specific series of events that have to occur to make this effective. Is that what I'm hearing?
100% correct.
Very good. Well, we're going to end up with something that is kind of my favorite part. And these are some survival stories. We talked about the ski hill, and it took a while to figure out why that was successful. But here's some other ones. And Joe, you can jump in, and Kurt. The first one's a retired fire chief. He was conscious and talking during head-up CPR. He was fully awake and oriented upon the arrival of the ED. What else do we know about this? Joe, do you have any interest, any data?
Oh, Kurt's got the details on this one.
Okay. Kurt?
Yeah. So with permission, I can share. His name is Wayne Kiewicz. He's a now retired fire chief of a suburb just to the south of Minneapolis called Richfield. And I had the privilege of working with Wayne for 20 some years and consider him a friend. He had a cardiac arrest at home. The chain of survival was all in place, so very much to his favor. A witnessed arrest in the home, 911 was called, son started CPR. He got a first round of drugs and defibrillation that didn't work. He got a second round of drugs that caused a spontaneous conversion to ROSC. So they quickly packaged him. And mind you, Wayne was in this device called the Eligard that supports head-up CPR correctly. And they quickly got him to the ambulance to take him to a medical center here that also performs ECMO as he was a candidate. And during the transport, he re-arrested. And the paramedic saw it right away, restarted the Lucas device, and Wayne remained conscious and talking. And he has, what's really unique is he has spotty memories of that. Not a complete picture, but spotty memories, which really speaks to this profound level of perfusion through the brain to not just have any level of brain function, but the ability to store some memories. And he was defibrillated, was converted again. And by the time they arrived at the ER, he was fully awake and oriented times three, went through a course of appropriate post-resuscitative care. And he was out of the hospital in, I think it was something like 56 hours, because he was doing that well.
Well, that's particularly cool when it's someone you know that can have this kind of recovery. That's wow. Okay, a different scenario here. Emmanuel was a 15-minute warm water drowning in a pool. He received head-up CPR and cooling and made a full recovery. Who knows about that one?
Yeah, that's another one for me that also happened in the Minneapolis-St. Paul area. This young man, just what you said, had a confirmed 15-minute warm water, fresh water drowning. And the first responders pulled him out of the pool. They started CPR. He was, you know, of an adult size. So he received this head-up CPR bundle of care. And he had a longer resuscitation, but he did achieve ROSC before they got to the hospital. And maybe Joel will touch on this, on the normal complications of a warm freshwater drowning, particularly with cerebral edema and such. But he had a longer hospital stay. In fact, his first EEG was negative, and there was concern that he had already sustained brain death. A follow-up EEG for confirmation showed positive signs, and within a few days of that, he woke up, and in about 2 weeks' time, he was actually playing catch with a physical therapist in his hospital room. And several weeks after that, he was discharged for some outpatient care and ultimately made a full recovery.
Wow, that's amazing. Jason Benjamin had 30 minutes of head-up CPR. CPR-induced consciousness was combative until he obtained ROSC. But day two in the ICU, he came up with the name neuroprotective CPR, which we've been mentioning. Is this a guy you referred to earlier?
I don't recall if I referred to Jason. Jason lives in the Florida area. He is a former EMT. He works in the area of organ harvesting and transplantation, specifically of lungs. And so he's very familiar with the more typical, more common outcome post-cardiac arrest. Most people don't die, and he very often is there to harvest organs to save other lives. And he again had the whole bundle of care, and the perfusion was so impactful that he was actually combative during CPR, making it very challenging for the firefighters to continue the resuscitation until they got ROSC. And imagine 30 minutes of CPR and you're awake within a day and answering questions. I think he tells a story. He was answering Jeopardy questions, and he gave that some more thought, thought, you know, we need a catchier name than head up CPR. And he actually sent a letter to Dr. Lurie going, you know, you should do something like neuroprotective. It's much more, you know, catchy. And he's been a great champion for showing what's possible.
Yeah, that makes sense, too. James Spurgio was a retired pilot. He had 15 minutes of CPR and woke up within several minutes of Rusk and demanded to see his wife before EMS transport. So he wasn't even in the ambulance yet.
Yeah, James was a UPS pilot at the time of his event. And he had at least 15 minutes, maybe closer to 20 minutes of CPR receiving this head-up bundle. They got ROSC on him. They prepared to transport him. They had to carry him down a flight of stairs. And halfway down the stairs, he woke up, took the eye gel out of his mouth, and demanded to see his wife, and was quite startling to the firefighters halfway down the stairs. And he had such a level of consciousness almost immediately. He was signing paperwork before they even left the scene. Wow. Just another incredible story. And again, it's the impact of this is twofold. One, we're seeing, you know, these profound results just from resuscitation in general, but the neurologic recovery is what is so, so remarkable on all these patients.
Indeed. Couple more and then we're done. Ken Commons was a 70-year-old retired man who had 72 minutes of head-up CPR. This included 12 shocks, 8 were DSD, followed commands 24 hours after ROSC, and had a full recovery within a week.
I had a really lovely conversation with Ken several months after his recovery. This was in St. John's County, Florida. That's the St. Augustine area. And that department there has just been doing such an amazing job. That's the same department that resuscitated Jason Benjamin we talked about. Ken had 72 minutes of CPR in total. In about 24 hours after ROSC, he was in the ICU. The nurse, the way he tells the story, the nurse had apparently come in the room, had said something to his wife, and he responded by giving a thumbs up. It took a few, it took a little longer for him to regain full consciousness, but he has had a full recovery within a few weeks of that event. I don't know the exact specifics of how long that took, but he has had complete neurologic recovery. He's what we call a CPC score 1. And you know, just another little comment about St. John's County, Florida. I just talked with their medical director, Dr. Carrie Bautista, today. They, to date, this year, have an 18% CPC-1 survival rate. That is more than double the national average.
Whoa, so it can be done. Joe, what do you think about that?
Well, I think that my two services that have been doing heads-up CPR for 2 or 3 years now are also seeing CPC-1 recoveries in the 18 to 20% range, and we also have seen substantial awakening during CPR. So much so that I've had to write a protocol for sedating patients while they're getting CPR, so that we can finish resuscitating them.
Beating you up.
I have a question real quick, Joe. CPC-1 rate of 18 to 20% as compared to what in the general population? Like nationwide, what are we looking at in other systems if we compare that to what they see doing CPR without this process?
So the overall resuscitation rates, as Kurt mentioned, are at least double, maybe a little bit more than that. We tend to see in, quote unquote, standard CPR, quite a bell curve in patient outcomes. And by that, I mean CPC scores of 1, which are basically normal, down to CPCs of 5, which are neurologically devastated but still alive. And with the majority of those patients, you know, floating around in the middle someplace. What's been interesting about the Heads Up CPR experience is that the curve seems to go the other way. If you survive, you generally survive neurologically intact. We just are not seeing many patients who survive that have substantial neurologic residue from their cardiac arrest.
Kurt, you want to mention what you just put in the sidebar?
Sure. What I was just offering is, and just because I happened to calculate these stats recently, but if you look at what Joe said, the national average for survival in a CPC category one or two, and maybe we need to take a minute to talk about what that is. But nationally, it's somewhere between 7 to 8, maybe 8.5% on a good year. People will survive at 7 to 8% overall. And there's a 10% survival nationally. That is what you see published more often, but not all those patients are neurologically recovered. Now, if we look at just the survivors, again, this is national average. Of all the people that do survive a cardiac arrest, nationally, about 78% of them will be CPC 1 or 2, and about 22% will be CPC 3 or 4. They bundle these categories. And just to give you a contrast, Des Moines Fire Department in 2024, rather than a 78% CPC 1, they were 93% CPC 1 and 2. And wow. Where nationally it's 22% CPC 3, 4, Des Moines Fire was only 7%.
Wow. Well, we saved the best for last. Dr. Jesse Adams collapsed on a golf course. There was unfortunately a delayed response for CPR, and the first shocks failed. But he was given head up for 15 to 20 minutes, and he became fully awake and conscious upon arrival at the ED. And we may have mentioned him. This is a cardiologist who first demonstrated the troponin assay as a superior test for MI. Kurt?
Yeah, so Dr. Adams is a highly experienced, highly accomplished cardiologist in the Louisville area, and has held prominent roles in the I'm not going to get this quite right, but the College of Cardiologists and their groups that they get in. Joe, you can probably give me the right name for that. It's blanking, but yeah, he collapsed while playing golf, and by coincidence, on the hole before them was another physician, a hospitalist, who saw him go down, and they rushed up to start CPR. There was some delay in trying to get 911 called, like you mentioned. And like happens more often than not, the first defibrillations were not effective to convert his shockable rhythm. And this continued resuscitation using the head-up bundle. They did ultimately achieve ROSC. And again, after a 12 to 15 minute transport time, he was fully awake and oriented. And, you know, this is American College of Cardiology. Thank you, Joe. This is not something that cardiologists are typically in tune with, because they're dealing with the survivors rather than being heavily focused in the area of the active resuscitation. And so all of this technology was brand new to him, but pretty amazing, being his contribution to medicine in being one of the first or the first authored person to promote the use of troponin as a much more effective lab study to rule out MI. Joe, maybe you can expand on that.
You did actually a great job. Troponin is a substance that's released into the blood when cardiac muscle cells are damaged. It is extremely sensitive, much more so than the blood-related markers that we look for before that, myoglobin and CPK and things like that. So it greatly enhanced our sensitivity for the workup of cardiac-related chest pain and the severity of the injury that someone experienced in a heart attack.
So
Becky,
Sam,
is still with us?
Sorry, Sam. I just want to make a quick side note that to ensure everybody understands that all these stories are shared with explicit permission from the individuals involved.
Well, they were all lucky men, and we're lucky to have them back. Becky, you still with us?
Are you gobsmacked? Yeah, honestly, a little bit. You know, I thought I had like a vague understanding of CPR because I've taken the basic courses, and a lot more to it, obviously, from a total layperson over here. So it's fascinating, absolutely fascinating.
Thanks for hanging in with us. Well, Jamie, I'm going to throw it back to you.
Okay, well, I just want to just say that this has been an amazing episode, and I think the physiology understanding that I have is much elevated from where it was before, and I thought I had a good understanding of the physiology of cardiac arrest and CPR, but I'm feeling much more knowledgeable now, and also, you know, humbled, you know, because of where this maybe needs to go, and we need to talk more about that in the future episode that'll follow on to this one. I do want to just ask real quick, Joe, you know, you've been doing a lot of the research for some of this, and you are associated with, you know, Paragon Medical Education Group and all some of the things you do in cadaver labs and studies that really get an understanding of how this works. How does that relate to the work you do with Paragon?
Well, it's just another aspect of what we are passionate about, which is education and the use of the amazing gifts that people's bodies that they donate to allow us to expand our knowledge and improve our education.
Where can folks find out more about what Paragon's doing and how to reach out to you if they want to get access to some of this amazing training that you're able to put together for them?
Well, we love to talk to folks. They can reach us on the web at Paragon Medical Education Group or on Facebook at Paragon Medical Group or through the Disaster Podcast. I just had two of those great conversations today about setting up some labs. So we look forward to talking to folks.
Thank you. And Kurt, you have been generous with your time and sharing about this, and I know you're passionate about it. Where can folks find out more about what you're doing and how to reach out to you?
Thank you, Jamie. I am passionate about it, and it's the people who survive, like the stories we shared. It's just a small number that just keep you driving, keep driving all of us forward. People are very welcome to contact me through email. It's Kurt Bramer, KurtBramer, all one word, at elevatedcpr.com.
Excellent. And Sam, this has been an amazing episode, and it's episode 4 in this series. So if you're listening to this episode and want to know a little bit of the earlier knowledge that we shared leading up to this point, please go back in the show notes for this episode. I will be providing links to all of the earlier 3 episodes before this one. And we will have at least one more to follow up on top of it. So looking forward to getting to that here soon.
Indeed, we'll be talking more about the new research, so that will be coming up. That should be exciting. But my final comment is, this is just a good example of we do the same thing for years and years, but maybe that's just the basics. Maybe we can get beyond the basics and do something amazing, like head up CPR.